I'm Mike Asnald, and welcome to the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge's AC23 Plus Artist Legacy Series podcast. This is a series where we talk to artists who are doing amazing things in the areas of the arts, including performance, education, production, as well as arts advocacy. We record this series in the Virginia and John Nolan Black Box Studio, as well as in the Jan and Bill Grimes Recording Studio here at the Cary Siraj Community Arts Center. Be sure to visit artsbr.org for more information on all the great things we are doing here at the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge. Hope you enjoy the podcast series, and thanks for tuning in.
Just when you think you got it all figured out, here comes something you never dreamed about. Life is so unpredictable, y'all. That's the way it is. It gets a little hard to bear sometimes. Things out of nowhere to blow your mind. But one thing I know for sure, hey, y'all, you got to let life flow. You got to let life flow. 1 minute you're up, the next minute you're down. Can't stay there, keep your feet on the ground. Life is so unpredictable, y'all. That's the way it is. It gets a little hard to bear sometimes. Things out of nowhere to blow your mind. But one thing I know for sure, hey, y'all, you got to let life flow. You got to let life flow. When you hit real hard and you feel the pain, you got to reach inside, find sunshine and rain. Life is so unpredictable, y'all. That's the way it is. You get a little hard to bear sometimes. Things out of nowhere to blow your mind. But one thing I know for sure, hey, y'all, we got to let life flow. Oh, yeah. We got to let life flow. We stay right there, y'all. That's the way it is. You got to let life flow. Get a little hard sometimes. That's the way it is. 1 minute you're up, the next minute you're down. You can't stay there. Keep your feet on the ground. That's the way it is. Yeah. We got to let life flow. We got to let life, we got to let life, we got to let life, we got to let life flow. We got to let life, we got to let life, we got to let life, we got to let life flow. We got to let life flow. Yeah, that's what we got to do, man.
Amen. Yeah. Mr. Kenny Neal.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to welcome all of our viewers and listeners to another session of AC23 Plus Artist Legacy Series. And that's the reason I wanted to have you on, Kenny, because you are an artist and you have a long legacy. Your family has a long legacy. Let me do a proper introduction. So, Louisiana Music Hall of Fame, multi-Grammy nominee,
yeah.
18, at least 18 albums?
Yeah, 18, 19 albums. About to be 20.
20? Baton Rouge has such a history. East Baton Rouge, West Baton Rouge, of course, South Louisiana, has such a long history of blues music, swamp blues, and you are a huge part of that. Your family's a huge part of that, and I just wanted to bring you on to talk to you about that and kind of, I know it's been documented many times, but just to have it, to sit down and talk with you about it.
Good, man.
Play some music.
Well, you know, I grew up in West Baton Rouge Parish.
Okay.
And I don't remember when I learned to play because my dad, you know, he was, first of all, my dad's mother passed when he was 2 months, his Rafe O'Neill.
Okay.
When he was 2 months old. Mm-hmm. So he was raised by some folks who were sharecropper farmers, you know.
Okay.
And for him, growing up as a teenager, he didn't want to work the land. And he got hip to Lil Walter and all these Chicago guys had the 78 records coming out. So he wanted to play blues and play harmonica.
Okay.
And went out and bought him a 35, 40-cent harmonica, and they said he used to ride his horse to the grocery store, and he'd stop under a tree, and he'd just taking his time out there playing on his harp, you know?
Right.
So he used to go and play at this little club called Spooners, which was the folks who raised my mother.
That's in West Baton Rouge.
West Baton Rouge. Mm-hmm. It was the only place teenagers can go and enjoy themselves as like if they was in a club or something.
Right.
And my dad would play on Sundays down there for them. It would be him, Buddy Guy, and a guy by the name of Noel Gaines on drums.
Yeah.
And then, so that's how he met my mom, because my mom would show up. She lived in the house next door to the little juke joint.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
They met each other like that.
Yeah.
So when I come along, my dad was already playing music and had a three-piece band.
Yeah.
So I don't remember learning to play. I just know I grew up in a household and we always had musicians around the house. And when I got big enough to understand a little better, I started turning 4, 5, 6 years old, man. I was trying to get gigs with my dad at that time.
Now, were you playing just about anything laying around, or was it mainly
I was
guitar?
Picking on the guitar or on the piano. I learned how to play Tell Me What I Say by Ray Charles.
Yeah,
I thought
yeah,
I had something, but
yeah.
When it was time to go to the gig, we couldn't take a piano to the gig, so
right,
I couldn't
right.
really show off, you know.
Yeah.
But we had people around the house like Slim Harpo.
Yeah.
I knew Slim Harpo well as a kid. I didn't like him, but I knew him.
And, okay. I'm not going to ask why.
Well, I'm going to tell you why, because he brought a trailer back to my dad. They used to share the trailers. I mean, I'd see a 1960 Cadillac with a little box trailer on the back of it, you know. So my dad would use it sometime for his gigs.
Yeah.
And Slim would deliver it to my dad. And one time Slim told me, say, go in there and see if any equipment left in and the trailer. Hmm. So I goes in and he closed the door on me, man. It go pitch dark and I start freaking out.
Well, how old are you?
I was about 6,
oh, okay.
7.
That's
just
terrifying.
A little kid, you know. And so he was felt so bad about it. He went into his car and grabbed the harmonica from under the front seat. Say, son, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to make you cry. And he handed me the harmonica, and I snatched it out of his hand and ran around the back of the house. So every time he came around, I was upset. Oh, here come that old man who locked me up in the trailer. You know, I didn't think about he was some Slim Harpo or nothing. He just
right.
was.
Yeah, you're not thinking of him as the
no,
legend.
No, no, that's just my dad friend who just pulled a bad trick on me. But I grew up around Lazy Lester, you know, Whispering Smith, yeah. Tabby Thomas.
Yeah, of course.
They used to call Whispering Moe's guy by the name of Chewing Gum. He had a band called Chewing Gum and the Gum Rappers.
Really? Okay.
All
right.
You know, all of them guys there, I grew up with them.
Yeah.
Zach the Cat. All these are Baton Rouge guys.
Yeah.
You know, long gone, but I remember them well. I come up under these guys. And they all admired me as a kid and rooted on for me.
Yeah.
And that they encouraged me.
And, you know, I mean, I already know the answer to this, but, like, as you're learning this music, it's all the oral tradition. I mean, you're just listening and learning.
Yeah.
But you're not talking about sheet music, right?
No. I didn't learn anything about sheet music until I turned about maybe 15 when I went to school and they had wind horns.
Right. And I learned treble clef and stuff like that. But other than that, this was all just from my heart, soul, and my ear.
Right. The best way to learn.
Yeah, that was it.
Wow. But, and you come from, I mean, as your family grew, you had 10 siblings, correct?
Yeah, I'm the eldest of the 10.
Wow.
And I my mom never complained.
So
nothing.
Did all of them play?
Man, we had so much noise around the house. You know, I don't know how my mom did it. My dad would be out. Sometime he would take other jobs, you know, to make ends meet.
Sure.
But his main thing was his music. But I think his main thing was his family.
Yeah.
Because he came from a family where he was raised up with just his sister, foster parents. So by us being the first family tree was very important for him.
Right.
And
right.
So he always took care of us and would take me out to matinees when I was 6, 7 years old, and I'll come back with more money than the bandmate, you know.
Yeah.
I'll dance on the bar and do my little thing and come back down, and everybody give me $2-3, and I have 2 pockets full of money.
So you're really at that early age, you're learning to not only the music, but like, I call it show business, or just the entertainment part of it.
Entertainment and learning that I can get paid for it.
Yeah.
That was the best thing.
You
know, wow, they're going to pay me to do this, and I love it so much. This is even better. So I knew from a kid this is what I wanted to do in
life.
You knew? I knew it.
Yeah.
It was just that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And whatever it took for me to do it, I was willing to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So as I turned 15, 16, 17, I remember working for Earl K. Long Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
When I was younger, I looked at older. So I grew a beard and went and filled out all the paperwork and said that I was 19 and I wasn't. But I got the gig, man. I got the job, you know. And so, you know, and I made history in West Baton Rouge because I was one of the first male workers to work in the cafeteria in Port Allen. So that was a big trip for me, and I was be off throughout the summer with the kids, and then I'd go back to work with the teachers.
Yeah.
So that was a cool job for me. I didn't have to work 12 months a year.
Right.
So I stayed there for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I played all over with Bobby Powell, he's from here, Baton Rouge, had a hit song called The Bells Will Be Ringing, like a Christmas song almost. Marion Jarvis from Port Allen.
Yeah.
She had a hit record in the South called Hell of a Fix at that time.
Yeah.
So when I didn't play with my dad, I would go and play with Bobby Powell.
And where were y'all recording most of the music? What studios would you
use? Right downtown, Overton.
Okay.
Overton had a studio right downtown here in Baton Rouge, and that was the spot. We two tracks, you know. Two tracks.
So you're not talking about overdubbing. Y'all just
no.
Just
you better get
it
right the first time. I remember when I went in. I was 15 years old and I played on a song Tabby Thomas recorded called "Ball Headed Lena."
Okay.
And I'm playing bass on it, and so we played the whole track. We go back in to listen, and Overton told Tabby, "Say, well, I didn't have the tape on." And Tabby never lived it down. That was the hit record, man. You blew it. We'll never do it again. It was two tracks, no overdubbing, nothing. You know, so, but that was my experience, and I must have grown real fast throughout my kids. I don't remember being like a kid, as in playing out in the yard and, you know, tussling with the other ones or going to the football games or the baseball games. I didn't have that kind of life. I was always going out on weekends bluesing like Andy Griffin and Opie, you know, they go fishing,
we go
bluesing, me and my dad.
So well, I was about to ask, like when you're younger, you know, you said your dad had to make ends meet every now and then, but he's mainly doing the music,
yeah.
And is he out on the road a lot?
He was on the road on weekends.
Okay.
From Friday, sometime Thursday, but mostly Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, he was out.
Right.
You know, and come back through the week. And he had a bass player, Cleve Jefferson. He's still around Baton Rouge.
Mm-hmm.
He's the cause of my career, I think, because he would always show up late. And my dad got tired of it. And I told my dad, I said, well, we waiting on him. I could play these songs on the bass. He said, you can? I said, yes, sir. He said, okay. He told Rudolph Richard and drummers, and y'all go ahead and kick off. Kenny said he can do it. And, man, I was so happy to take that place. That was the end of Cleve's job. I always tell Cleve.
Lesson to musicians.
Oh, when I see him now, I say, thanks a lot, Cleve, for being late. We're still good friends.
Right.
And but I started playing bass, and my dad never worried about a bass player until I left home. When I turned 19, I left here with Buddy Guy.
Okay. So your real first professional performing was on bass?
On bass. Okay. That was my ex.
Right.
And then I would play with different bands around town. It was a band called the Herkalards. Mm-hmm. I played with them. I played with Harvey Knox. I played with, Bobby, my dad. And, you know, guys might need a bass player on weekends, and I was off that night.
Right.
I'll go play the Herkalards.
Yeah.
They was around then. And, man, it's so nice to find. I've found a lot of 45 records that was hard for me to find because I remember them as a kid, but because they was just local, you can't really put your hands on them anymore, you
right.
know?
Yeah.
Obsolete. But I do have a few of the local guys' 45s and around home.
Right.
You know? But I was playing one Friday night at a place called the Executive Club on Plank Road.
Mm-hmm.
And Sam Guy, Buddy Guy, brother, dropped a note in my pocket. And I got off for my break. You know, back then you play 2 hours before you take a break.
Right.
And they say, Buddy Guy, say, call him. So I said, damn, Buddy Guy want me to work. Call him for what?
Mm-hmm.
What do he want? And then I got on the payphone and called him Collect.
That's Buddy Guy.
And he said that he was going to be playing in Antone's in Austin, Texas next Tuesday. And this is a Friday night. And I'm like, well, I have to check with my parents because I don't know if I can, you know,
right.
do this. He said, well, I'll call your dad because, you know, Buddy was in my dad's band before he left Baton Rouge.
Yeah.
He was my dad's guitar player.
Yeah.
So his brother, Phil Guy, had told him he'd been down here and saw me play. And he said, Phil told me you're a great bass player. And if you want to join us, you know, we can put you on a bus and meet us at Antone's in Austin. And I went back home the next morning. My dad was good with it. My mom wasn't.
Oh.
She didn't want me to leave. Her firstborn, you know. So she was a little heartbroken.
Right.
But my dad was like, get your suitcase, son.
But I'm sure it helped because he knew the family. I mean, y'all were connected.
Yeah, oh, so, yeah. So he was.
Probably gave your mom a little ease, like, you know, and she knew.
Yeah, she knew I was going with Buddy Guy and Philip Guy. And my mom was real close with Philip as well. And so that was a little ease for them knowing. But damn, I got to Chicago and Buddy was supposed to take care of me. I got back to Chicago. I didn't even see Buddy.
Oh.
I ended up staying in Phil Guy, had a utility room, and it's a beautiful house, but the utility room where the dryer and the washer go, that was my bedroom. I got a little day bed and a little stand beside it.
Right.
And I would rent from them by the month. And they didn't charge me.
So you were living in Chicago?
I was living in Chicago. After I went to Austin and got the gig with Buddy, I needed somewhere to stay, and Phil hooked me up.
Okay.
And I stayed at his house for about a year, man, before I got out on my own.
So that whole time with Buddy, are y'all like, paint a picture for me. Are y'all traveling around?
Traveling all over.
Yeah.
Traveling with a 1976 Chevrolet van with the bench seats in it, really uncomfortable, with a bass amp in the back, guitar amp, set of drums.
Right.
That was it. And Bonnie Raitt used to open up for us.
No kidding.
Her and Freebo, the tuba player.
Right.
It was just the two of them at the time.
Wow.
And sometime they wouldn't even have rooms for them. And Bonnie and them would sleep in the van. They were still like hippies, man, you know? I remember it so well, you know, and we talk about it when I do see her because it's so far back in 76.
Right.
And it opened my eyes to a whole different world about my music because I always played music as, you know, listening, learning the songs that my daddy wanted to play, but I never thought about the business end of it.
Right.
You know, it was just, oh, let's have some fun. We're going to play these songs and people dancing.
Right.
But when I got to Chicago, man, I saw so many blues musicians. I saw so many other guys that was going to Europe for a month, and they had their own band, and they wasn't good. They wasn't that good. So
but
I'm
but
saying
their business side was good.
The business sides were good because they was had contracts in their back pocket. There you go. Yeah. I'm going to France next month.
Right.
I'm going, damn. And he's playing like that in my head, you know. I could do better than this guy
right.
in my head. I'm not telling them that.
Sure,
I'm just thinking.
Yeah.
So what you got to do to get to that part? And I found out that if you get down the serious business, start writing your songs, mm-hmm. putting your own music together. And I was told you needed about 10 songs. So, man, I got home and I start working on songs,
right.
buying me a little recording machine and putting my tracks down.
Yeah.
And
the idea being getting a record deal?
Yeah, I was trying to get a record deal at that time. I was still playing with Buddy, but mm-hmm. when I get home, I would work on my own for myself.
Right.
And I got about 8 or 9 songs in, you know, and I would go and buy albums just to get the address of the record label. You know, it wasn't for the music of the artist.
Right, right.
It's like I look at the bottom, and go, oh yeah.
And were most of those guys were what, in Chicago?
Chicago, I was
Los
right
Angeles?
Under their nose.
Okay.
A few in Michigan and. I had a couple Southern folks down here in the South that was, once I got into it, I found out more about record companies.
Right.
So I got this letter in my office now. I think it's 1979 or 1980. It was, I sent it to Bruce Iglart at Alligator Records.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent it back really a nice no thank you letter, kind of like that, you know.
Right.
You're not quite ready yet,
right?
You know, but I'm interested in anything else you got. Let me hear it. So I wouldn't give up on the guy, man.
Right.
I remember I phoned him one time, and it wasn't even his office. He don't know how I got his home phone number. Hmm. He was just getting out the shower. He was more amazed. He go, how did you get this number? Where did you get this number from? This is my home number. I said, oh, man, I'm in trouble. And I stayed on him. I wouldn't stop. And I ended up doing 7 albums for that label, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember one Christmas I framed his letter, his rejection letter, and I sent it to him for a Christmas present.
Yeah. Well, tell me about that, Kenny. Like, you went from being a sideman to basically a band leader.
Yeah.
Like, you have your own record deal. You're writing your own tunes.
Well, before I got my record deal, I met a girl in Canada, an Italian girl,
mm-hmm.
and she was in Toronto. So I was playing with Buddy, and I was going back to see my girlfriend in Canada.
Yeah.
And so the music business got real bad for a while for the blues.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the blues was dying out. Buddy then would have gigs scattered here and there. So I was in Toronto, and I was still working on my songs. This guitar, 47 years now.
Yeah.
Same guitar.
Does it have a name?
Betsy.
Betsy, all right.
But, yes, 47 years now with this guitar. This is the one that I found that I really liked, and I felt comfortable with it.
Yeah.
And I wrote all my songs on it.
Right.
And it's been with me ever since.
Wow.
With 4 or 5 different frets on it, you know, fret jobs.
Yeah.
But, I was living up in Canada, and I go, man, it's expensive up here. That was back then, the 80s. You know, to me, it was expensive because I come from the South.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to figure out, how can I get out of this? Buddy is not working that much. I was working with Buddy Guy and Junior Wells, was the band at that time. So I would go to a little place called the Isabella Hotel, and at the very top, they had a blues club up there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I met the owner of the place, and I said, hey, man, I said, I can put a house band together here, and I can bring in Buddy Guy. I can bring in Junior Wells. I can bring in Big Mama Thornton.
These are people you all know, obviously.
I met them through Buddy there.
Right.
and I got along with everybody. Mm-hmm. So I would take their phone number. And he said, really? I said, yeah. I don't have a clue about what I'm doing. I know what I'm saying.
You're selling it. Well.
I'm selling it. So I sold it for 3 months.
Yeah.
He gave me a three-month deal. I go, oh, man, what I do now? So I go, I know what I'll do. I'll go back home and get my little brothers. My dad had just started breaking them in as mm-hmm. the Neal Brothers Band.
Yeah.
So I came back to Baton Rouge, bought a Ford van, loaded my brothers up, took them back to Canada with me.
So this is their first stint.
They'd never been nowhere
right.
other than Port Allen. So I take them back to Canada, and I think the first week I had Phil Guy as a guest, uh-huh. 5 days.
Yeah.
They pay for the hotel's flight. If you wanted to drive, you can drive from Chicago to Toronto. Next week I had Buddy Guy with me for a week. Next week I had Junior Wells. Next week I have Big Mama Thornton.
And you're playing bass and all this?
No, I'm playing guitar now.
Playing guitar.
I left the bass alone. I'm starting my own band.
Yeah.
And I didn't have a record at all at that time. And, man, it was so successful. Every night I was packed. Hmm. I used to keep Big Mama Thornton. She was the one, You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog and Ball and Chain.
Yeah.
That's her. And I would bring her in for 2 weeks. I found that was easy because mm-hmm. I could pack the place for 2 weeks with Big Mama Thornton,
yeah.
You know. And so it lasted, and I was still writing my songs. I had two kids during that time, my son and my daughter. She's mm-hmm. living in Louisiana now, but she was born in Canada, mm-hmm. Sarita Neal, and my son, Kenny Jr.
Yeah.
He's still in Toronto, and my grandkids are still up there.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. So I go back to Canada. I'm stuck there forever. That's my roots, too.
It's not a bad place to go.
No, very beautiful place. And so I went through a divorce and came back home. Yeah. And now I really got to get to work.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 20-some years old going through a divorce, not yeah. knowing young, you know.
Uh-huh.
And, man, I end up meeting this guy, Bob Greenlee, out of Sanford, Florida. And he came down to Baton Rouge because what I did, the government had gave me a grant to do an album on my own, but they gave me time in the studio. So I recorded with that grant. And when I got back to Baton Rouge, the only thing I had was a master's. So I went up to Ville Platte up there, mm-hmm. Floyd's,
yeah.
Jay Miller.
Yeah.
Went to Jay Miller and told him I was Ray Fanil's son and I wanted to make a 45 record. I figured if I get a 45 record, and sent around to all the radio stations, I can get my name known out there.
Right.
So that's what I did.
Yeah.
I made 500. And I'll never forget. Oh, man, sorry about that.
That's all good.
I never forget. He said, and you Rafe's son, huh? I said, yes, sir. He said, look, tell a guy back there to give you them 2 5-gallon cans of wax back there and pull that in the machine. And he gave me another 250 records.
Really?
So they pulled the wax in, and I wasn't trying to sell them. It wasn't about selling. I wanted to send all these 45s to different radio stations.
Almost like an audio business card,
yeah.
if you will.
Yeah. So I did it, and I went down to Florida. I mean, sent it to a guy by the name of Bob Shy down in Florida.
Yeah.
And cut this off. And Bob Greenlee heard me on the radio, and he called in and said, who is that guy? I was doing one of my dad's songs, Change My Way of Living. Oh, he's from Baton Rouge, Kenny Neal, his dad, Rafe Neal. He said, man, we need to go down there. So him and the DJ, they flew down to Baton Rouge to find me.
He was from where?
Sanford, Florida, just outside of Orlando.
Okay.
So he flew here, and he was here for 3 or 4 days before he can catch up with me because I was young and wild. You know.
Mm-hmm.
My mom said, this guy here looking for you, he's been by 3 or 4 times. I said, oh, I'll catch him later, you know.
Right.
So finally, you know, before he left, I went in, and he said, look, man, I really like what you do. I got a new studio. I have a new record label. I'd love to sign you up. And I said, well, if you sign me up and you sign my dad up and we do my dad album first, I say, I'll do a deal with you.
Oh, yeah.
I say, but I don't want to do a deal without doing my dad first.
Yeah.
So that wasn't a problem. He said, no problem. So me and my dad jumped on a plane, went to Orlando, did his album called Rafa Neal Legends. Yeah. I produced it with Bob Greenlee.
Yeah.
And then after that album, we went on to make Kenny Neal album, and we named it Bio on the Bayou.
Okay.
Man, we got so much recognition across the country with his label and my new album because we had just bought one of the brand new 2-inch track tapes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So Chicago didn't have the sound we had.
Right.
They were still with that quarter inch right. stuff, you know. So we had this big, fat, bluesy sound.
Yeah.
And I think that was one of the things impressed Alligator Records as well.
Right.
The sound, I mean, the music was good.
Mm-hmm.
And the sound and the quality. So we had something. And Bruce from Alligator say, hey, man, I'd like to come down to Florida and catch Kenny live. So we flew him down, and we hung out.
Mm-hmm.
And my manager was from Bob Greenlee from the the record company. He was, like, so sure of himself. The next morning, we had a meeting. So my manager walks in and go, okay, Bruce, what are we going to name this record? I go, damn, he's making a pretty cold-blooded move there, you know?
Right.
He said, hey, man, we haven't even started the meeting yet, and you talking about what I'm going to name the album?
Right.
But that's just the way Bob was. Yeah. He's gone now, but, man, he loved me dearly,
and
he believed in me.
So he was in your corner.
He was in my corner 150%, bro.
Yeah.
And, you know, he played for the Dolphins. He millionaire over and over again. He went to Yale.
Yeah.
But his heart was in the blues,
you
know, and he didn't care about that. He go, man, I'm out on the field practicing with the Miami Dolphins. And he go, man, I'm already rich. I don't need nothing. What am I getting beat up for? Let me go play my music because he's a great musician and stuff. So, he just took care of me and looked out for me. We made the third album that we was doing. James Brown had got into some real bad trouble back then. So the horn players was, the band wasn't working.
You're talking about the James Brown?
Yeah.
Like so, Maceo and
Maceo.
All those
guys? Yeah. So we give Maceo and Fred Wesley and Pete them a call and say, how you like to come down and do an album with Kenny Neal? Kenny who? Yeah, Kenny Neal, we got this artist here. We'd like to have you down and do the horn section. So they fell for it. And the album is called Walking on Fire.
Okay.
With the JB Horns.
Yeah.
Man, it's nice, slick.
Yeah.
So I did the album, man. I was so thrilled to have Fred Wesley and Maceo and them play on my record.
Yeah, legends.
So it even got better. I got ready to do a tour. And I was so excited about it that they said that they would go on tour with me, Maceo and Fred.
Yeah.
And I go, man, you really going to do it? Yeah, man, we'll do the tour with you. So in the middle of that, we get a call from the Lincoln Center.
In New York.
New York. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They'd like for Kenny Neal to come in and read for a Broadway show.
Okay.
I go, Broadway show, man. I ain't no
actor. Acting.
Yeah. I go, Bob, man, I'm into my music now. I don't want to do no Broadway stuff. You know, Broadway was nothing to me.
Right.
I was so into, I got my third album going. He said, yeah, but it might be good to go up and read for it. I go, read for it. So we caught a flight, went to New York. I go in. I'm sitting there. It was awful, man. I'm got to tell you, like, it was not good.
So what was the part? Like,
man, I end up, I read for it, number one, and I come back out, and I told my manager, I said, we might as well wrap this up and go back to Florida. I said, but Albert King playing tonight at the Blue Note. So we went out to see Albert King and flew back the next day. And I go, Bob, we're not going to get this call back. Man, about 2 weeks later, they called me back. Congratulations, you got the part. I had the lead role in a Broadway show called Mewbone. okay. written by Zora Neale Hurston and Langston Hughes.
Langston Hughes.
Mm-hmm. Taj Mahal, mm-hmm. had recommended me. They was looking for a younger guy who knew the blues. Instead of getting an actor and teaching him the blues, they got me and taught me how to act.
Right.
So I had to go through 3 months of intensive coaching lessons.
Really?
Miss Novella Nelson was my coach.
Yeah.
And it was really
How did you enjoy
strict,
it?
Yeah. Discipline. Mm-hmm. You know. And I sat around the table and read for 3 months with other actors. Now I find out that I have to get up and move on the lines. It's not just sitting at the table reading now. When you say, well, I'm going to do this, and you have to end up on that spot. I say, oh, man. But they tricked me because every morning I would do a half an hour workout, mm-hmm. and I'd do exercises. And so I had to learn all of these exercises. And I'm just thinking that they're keeping me in shape for Broadway, which was good to be exercising. But what they was teaching me was dance moves, but they didn't tell me. They say, now, when you say this line, do number 13 in your workout. And I did it, and it worked, you know. So after I got the ball and started rolling, it was a love triangle play by a guy named Joe Clark, who bought his own property, 200 acres, and started his own town.
But is it based in the blues somehow?
No, it's a real story about Joe Clark down in Eatonville, Florida.
Okay.
Had 200 acres of land, but had his own town.
Yeah.
But then me and my friend, I was a guitar player and singer, and he was a dancer. And the most exciting thing in the town was when Jim and Dave come into town and start playing the music and the front porch light up, you know, that kind of thing. But it was one girl named Daisy we was both in love with.
Okay.
So we end up fighting over her. And
right.
So it was that love triangle story, but Joe Clark didn't know when I beat Dave up. He told a marshal to put me in jail, but he didn't build a jail. So he had nowhere to put me, so they threw me in the barn for the weekend. So it was a cute little story. And you can still go to the Lincoln Center in New York and pull it up.
Okay.
It's in the archives.
So how long did that run? How long were you doing that?
Oh, man, I must have lived in New York, or I ran about 7 months or so.
Yeah.
Maybe a little longer, but I was there over a year doing the play.
Yeah.
And so, man, I went at it full force. I had the lead role. I mean, they groomed me so good. I mean, I was ready for it. And they came in and said, the show is going to be closing. So all the actors are crying around the theater, and I'm going, thank you, Jesus.
Yeah, you're ready to hit the road.
I said, thank you, man. It's over with. And so I put on a sad look when they say, you know, we're closing.
Well, you're an actor now.
Yeah, yeah. We're closing. Oh, man, it's too bad. And now I'm knowing that I got all of this waiting for me. That was the great thing about it.
Yeah.
So I come off of Broadway, and I got ready to go do a tour with Mazio and Fred Wesley. And when I was in New York, and I said, let me call a couple of the actors in New York while I'm at the Kennedy Airport just to say hello. So I call up Joanne Ebony, and she said, oh, congratulations, Kenny. I go, I call and say, how you doing? What you saying, congratulations, because I'm going to Europe? She said, no, it just came out in New York Times today that you're nominated for the most outstanding newcoming actor. You won. You won for the most outstanding newcoming actor on Broadway.
Right, right.
I got it here in Baton Rouge right now, man. I got my...
Wow. But you had no idea.
I had no idea. I was calling to say hello. So I did my tour, and just so happened, everything worked out. On my way back from Europe was the ceremony for the Theater World Award.
Yeah.
So I say, nobody better than my coach, Miss Novella Nelson. So I took her as my date to accept the award.
Yeah.
And that's how my Broadway show came about.
Yeah.
It was crazy, man.
You've had a fascinating life, man.
Man, it's crazy.
So far.
Yeah. So it's been nuts, but it's been good, you know.
Well, I mean, talk about, is it fair to say that in the blues world, because you've toured all around,
mm-hmm.
But you mentioned these names, these famous names that are basically family to you, whether they're, you know, they passed on or not.
Yeah, that was just our friends and family, man.
But is it fair to say that world is a fairly, it's a very connected world? No matter where you are, if you're in Chicago or New York, people know each other.
You got
family.
They
know the cats down in South.
That's right.
You know, your dad.
Yeah.
You know, buddy. And those.
I mean, all the way from Baton Rouge to Russia.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
I played in St. Pete Square, and I'm out there signing autographs in Russia, Moscow, and this guy come up with my dad, 45. Sunny Side of Love, B-side, Crying Heart. Man, I wanted to just take that record because we didn't have it. We had a house that burned down and all our pictures and everything was lost. So we had no clue to how to find this record. Yeah. I have it now. Right. I found it since. But this guy had my dad record in a nice pack. He said, can you sign this for me? And I go, man. He said, I used to have to hide this in the 60s. Because when the people come through and just check your house, if you had anything from America in there, you had a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you don't know how many times I hit this record.
Oh, wow.
You know, but it's a very close connection with it, being a blues artist and getting in, because people read about us and they feel like they know about us and they want to talk to me. And yeah, it's been very good across the country. I just got back from Romania. Yeah, and pack house.
Right.
I mean, I'm talking about 15, 20,000 people, easy.
And, you know, I mean, thinking back when you're 18 years old, before you went on the road with Buddy Guy, I mean, the life that music would have given you, I'm guessing you couldn't have imagined that.
No, I always knew I was going to do music.
Right.
I knew something was going to come off because, man, when I was small, I used to look at the airplane. You know, I come from West Baton Rouge, so when they started to descend out in the country over there, late in the evenings, I could see the lights on in the airplane in each window.
Right.
And I go, man, one day I'm going to be on that plane. I used to have that dream. So in my head, my heart, I knew something was going to happen.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I didn't know how or when, but I knew something was coming.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't going to give up.
Well, and again, kind of harp on this a little bit more, but like, you know, blues is all around the world. You've been all around the world. But, you know, part of this podcast thing is all about documenting people from South Louisiana, but in this case, Baton Rouge, West Baton Rouge. And is it fair to say, man, that the blues tradition, Baton Rouge has contributed a whole lot to the world when it comes to the blues tradition?
I feel like the root.
Yeah.
To the gumbo, you know? Where I come from, I feel very blessed to know that this swamp southern blues that's all over the world, you know? Take Mick Jagger. Me and Mick Jagger are friends.
Mm-hmm.
I just before COVID, I went spend 2 weeks out on Mystique Island at his house. We play on the ocean in the evenings and go out there and play the blues. And, you know, he paid for the whole trip, come out. Because of Mr. Henry Gray, Scratch My Back, Slim Harpo, you know. And so Mick and Keith and all of them, man, they hard as down here in Baton Rouge.
And well, you have that whole, there's a Chess Records tradition, like so many artists.
Yeah.
But you hear those English guys talk about that.
Yeah, and you got Excello here.
Uh-huh.
You know, Excello was our chess.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And it just connects everybody together, man. And, you know, me and Mick just trying to have a good conversation and hang out. And he asking me questions about Louisiana. And here we got people bumping us all. Can we get a picture, please? you know.
Right.
But, they're deeply into the culture and the roots that they got it from. And I came around that same era.
Right.
So, man, it's just been a good trip, been a good ride.
Yeah.
You know, and coming from this part of the country, I was very proud to represent where I come from.
Right.
I was like the fruit of the tree from, you know, the roots.
Right.
You know?
Well, what are you excited about now? Like, what's going on?
I'm excited now because I'm passing it on. I have a studio here where I bring the young kids who can't afford to record, and I make it happen. It's not about the money. It's about getting them in there, letting them be creative. Because if you give them an opportunity like Bob gave me, that's all they need.
Right.
That's all they need is that opportunity. So my grandson and my daughter just moved back from L.A., so I got a grandson here and a granddaughter here, and my my daughter. My other kids are in Toronto. And just for me to be able to, like, next month, I got this food drive, and it's my grandson's idea to put all of the musicians together. He's in a kid's band that plays blues. I mean, they're playing Raining in My Heart and stuff like that. That's Slim Harpo. So he got three kids' band that's going to play. We got a gospel group. Of course, I got to play. He told me I have to play, so I, ain't, I don't have no other choice. But just passing it on to the younger generation. And I give guitars to kids all over the country. We have a company, organization called Kids Rock the Nation. And our plans was to give out a million guitars. And we've been giving them out for right at 20 years now.
No kidding.
Yeah.
And what's, the name of,
Kids Rock the Nation.
Okay.
And we've come to Baton Rouge, West Baton Rouge, and gave away many, many guitars. And I go to Philadelphia, I go to Washington, D.C., and we do the same thing, you know. Just,
so that's really hip.
That's to keep me busy. I don't know if, I guess I'm getting into my golden years right now. I just turned 68 last week.
You're halfway there.
Yeah, that's right. So I got a lot to do to keep me busy. You know, I don't want to be beating myself up and down the road like when I used to do 280, 90 dates a year. Because I used to try to beat Mr. B.B. King out all the time. I say,
Well, you brought him up. Because I forgot I was going to ask you, but not to stop your thought. So your family is very close to B.B.
Oh, yeah, man. We're very close. B.B. is like an uncle. You know, he's been the... Man, I was in Tokyo touring with B.B., and I'm thinking he in the dressing room, right? And I'm playing and just playing these old songs way back in the days. And I look around, he's standing there in his tuxedo behind the drummer just watching my whole show. And I go, oh, man, I didn't know he was back there. But that's when me and him got close because he called me up. He said, look, Kenny, he said, man, I really love what you do. He said, just keep it up and play your own songs. He said, I listen to your album. And the stuff that you write are great music, he said. And I don't let anybody come on my stage, he said, but you're exception to the rule. I want you to come out with your guitar tonight and let's do some playing.
What an honor.
And,
man.
And that night, from that time on, we've been tight. I got a big picture later in the years where he opened up the B.B. King clubs. And me and him did his grand opening in New York together at the B.B. King club. But... he's the man paved the way. And I have a video that the YouTube, you can go over to YouTube and see. It's called Thank You, B.B. King. And I did it just before he passed away, and I got it to him. And he had a chance to watch the video before he left here. So I got a chance to thank him for paving the way for us.
Well, speaking of thank yous, I want to thank you, man, for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure, man.
Being a part of this.
Good to be home. And
I can't believe, you know, I'm born and raised here. I'm 56 years old. I've been a musician for 40 years. And shame on me, because I think this is the first time we've met.
Really? Okay.
And I've seen you play, you know, the Blues Festival, Jazz Fest, you know. But it's a real pleasure, man.
Good. It's all good, man. We have to stay in touch.
Absolutely. Well, can I convince you to play one more that I'd like to send the listeners out on?
And I could do a song, you know, Slim Harpo did King Bee, right?
Okay.
This is when I first did my first album. This came out in 86.
Okay.
I wrote this song.
All right.
And it's me thinking about Slim Harpo, say Baby Bee. I mean King Bee. So I wrote a song called Baby Bee. Well, you got me at work. Working around the clock. I want a drink of water.
You won't let Kenny stop, big boss man. Can you help me when I call? Well, you ain't so big, you just tall as a... It's called a Mississippi saxophone.
The Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge would like to acknowledge our generous sponsors, the Shell Corporation, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Louisiana Office of Cultural Development, and the City of Baton Rouge.